We're well into the 9 days of Dhamma, about two-thirds of the way through of this practice session. And it's been quite wonderful, really, to just be practicing together. So often, the daily routine of the monastery, I think, is oriented towards accomplishing the tasks that need to be done and framed by morning puja, evening puja, and periods of solitary afternoon practice. So it's not all that common that we have full days of practice together, and have, particularly the past couple of years, this is the first time that we've actually had a number of people on site for practice periods throughout this week. So it's been really nice to have part of the opening up since the past year and a half or so in this way. And there's been a lot of remembrances and reflections of the past 25 years of Abhayagiri, since before we even opened, up through the opening day and the first number of years. And various members of our wide community have come and spent a day here and there, and Santi Deva, Fred, was part of the Sangapala Foundation since before the monastery opened. So it's great to see him, and we've had others like Sisakun was here the other day, and others come and go. And I don't think I'll go into any major remembrances of events that helped us get started and formed. We've heard a lot about that, so I don't know if I have all that much more to add to the historical perspective. But just to remark on one thing in particular that I thought would be nice to just talk about a bit today was a very important part of our community that has evolved over the years. And both Lungpa and Ajahn Yanako have referred to it, and I thought I'd just maybe kind of talk about it a little bit more, and that's the that the monastery is really all about the people and the community. We've got, of course, lovely physical facilities, all the requisites, but it wouldn't be anything without the people, without the community. And I think that we've put a lot of conscious effort into that aspect, starting right at the beginning with Ajahn Amaro and Lungpa coming together and working out a working relationship with each other that involved a lot of mutual respect for each other. And their relationship as co-abbots was a model for us to follow, to see how people could work together harmoniously. All the Thai Ajahns were skeptical, I think, that it could work. I think one comparison or one simile that was put out there was, is this like putting together two tigers in the same cage, having two very strong leaders share leadership. Wasn't something that was predicted to work out so well, but Lungpa and Ajahn Amaro made it work very well. And that was quite a guiding influence for how we in the community were to develop our relationships with each other. So communal harmony has been a very big and important part of establishing our life here, and that's certainly, we've had many ups and downs and community difficulties, and it's not been necessarily an easy go But that commitment to keep on making it work and working out the wrinkles as they come up has been a hallmark, I think, of our monastery. The Buddha talks about harmony, establishing harmony in all the communities. He, you know, of course, he emphasized communal harmony in terms of the monastic communities, because that was what he was setting up primarily. But all of the principles that he talked about in terms of how to establish community harmony really apply in the greater world for the whole assembly of practitioners in our traditions. And so the same principles can apply to family life or to intentional communities or to communal living situations or even to places like, you know, workplaces, any place where people gather together. There are certain guidelines that the Buddha offered that make life just a whole lot more easy. And emphasizing just the prioritizing of harmony in community and people living together. You know, more important than many, many aspects of the practice and the teachings. The Buddha was incredibly practical. He not only taught a really profound Dhamma teaching for the true liberation of the heart, but he was also incredibly practical in laying down many, many different ideas about how to live together in community, in particular for the monastics, the Vinaya, the code of discipline with all of its protocols and practical suggestions that Ajahn Janaka was referring to in the Khor Wat, the monastery procedures and protocols that just help grease the wheels of good communication and acting together in a harmonious way. And then also taking into account our individual cultural needs as a Western community. I think, you know, I've spent a little bit of time in Thailand, not a huge amount, but enough to get a flavor, and have heard many times from others who have spent much more time there how different, in a way, the Thai cultural conditioning is around groups and people, and that there's much less of a individual need or a need to express one's individuality, and much more of an emphasis on blending together and establishing oneself as part of a group, kind of losing oneself, letting go of one's individual needs to express, you know, identity or establish oneself as a singular being, and more emphasis on how to blend together and be with each other and live together in close quarters, you know, much more so than Westerners are conditioned to. So we've had to put some special conscious care and effort into establishing how to live together in some very close quarters without having that kind of training since our childhood, much more of the individual, looking out for oneself as an individual. So that's a real learning curve, I think, for a lot of people in the West, and particularly here in the monastic community and in the early days, and even now to some extent, we have some fairly tight spaces that we all have to kind of negotiate around, and a lot of emphasis on communal activity. Some monasteries in the Thai forest tradition have much more of an emphasis on individual solitary practice. And Ajahn Chah hallmark was always emphasizing the communal aspect of the practice. So we find ourselves spending quite a bit of time together and needing to learn how to do that smoothly. One of the teachings that the Buddha gives around this whole theme of living together harmoniously came as a result of a conflict in the monastic sangha. At one point, many people are probably familiar with the quarrel at Kosambi, where two groups of monks were divided against each other based on just a disagreement on a very small Vinaya question. It ended up being people taking sides and having very strong views and opinions and engaging in what's called stabbing each other with verbal daggers. And it was getting close to leading towards a schism in the community, a complete division. And at one point, the Buddha was called in to give his advice or offer his instruction in that. And he did his best with this group. What resulted was he enumerated six grounds for establishing harmony in a community called the Saraniya Dhammas, the Dhammas that are conducive to harmony, developing harmony. And the teaching he gave was pretty straightforward, but it was something that wasn't taken too very kindly by the groups of monks that were receiving it, but still advice that we refer to over and over again in terms of trying to establish how we can live together communally here, it applies to everybody. But the first way to establish well-being and harmony with a group of people is to practice continuously with experiencing and having thoughts or let me say portraying or having loving kindness in acts of body and acts of speech and acts of mind, body, speech, and mind, really trying to establish a mind and a heart and bodily action and bodily speech based on metta, loving kindness. So that forms the foundation for communal harmony. And it's important to realize that loving kindness isn't really just kind of a syrupy, you know, going around pretending you love everybody and expressing it in that way, but more of a broad state of mind that results in expressions that are very spacious, very boundless, very broad, very allowing, giving a lot of clarity and awareness to the fact that we aren't solitary beings, that we live in a space with other beings, and how to be accepting and spacious with whatever it is that comes along, and a lot comes along in a community like this. But particularly starting with the more overt aspects of trying to experience loving kindness with bodily action, one of the nicest examples that I can remember from the suttas is when. And it was after he gave this talk to the monks, and the monks didn't really listen to him. The Buddha got up and left and went, left that particular area and went wandering and came across another a group of monks who were living together harmoniously, three monks who were living together harmoniously. And he asked them, how did that come about? And they told him, of course, that they were practicing loving kindness in body, speech, and mind with each other. And then talked a little bit about their daily routine, and they had their routines that they would go through, go on alms round in the morning, and when they would come back, the first one who would come back would set up for the meal, And then they would all come together, have their meal, and whoever was the last finished would initiate the cleanup and get that all taken care of. And they would do all of this without speaking to each other. They just kind of intuited what needed to be done, looked out for each other, kept their eyes open, and established an ethic to just support each other and keep their eyes open to what the needs were of the particular community at that time. And particularly with an attitude, as they said, of always trying to set aside what it is that I want to do and doing what my venerable friends want to do. So rather than me first, it's always looking around and saying, well, if we have differences of what we think needs to be done, maybe the most harmonious thing to do would be to let go of what I think needs to be done and do what others would like to do. That's a tall order for some of us. but as a standard, it's a very good one to remember and try and live up to. So in everything we do, we keep our eyes open, we look out for each other. And in our small space here, I think that's something that we've generally done a pretty good job of, because it's been emphasized and taught, and in a way, it's kind of a matter of survival. If we all want to stay living together, we don't really have the option of a lot of conflict. So we learn how to do that through just keeping our eyes open and giving priority to what others see as a good thing to do. In terms of speech, that's probably one of the hardest areas that any of us, I think, one of the biggest challenges in terms of maintaining harmonious speech. And, there are guidelines in the suttas about how to speak honestly, speak at the right time, in the right situation, and with a heart of kindness, an intentional kindness. And that's something that we've all really needed to work and practice on. And one of the ways that's kind of been picked up here since the very early days is coming together every couple of weeks in a group format to just be with each other, not doing business, but coming together as a community. One group as just the bhikkhus, the monks, and another group as the novices and anagarikas and long-term lay residents, to meet every 2 weeks and just share what's going on with our lives on a personal level. And then once every 6 weeks or so, coming together as a whole community. And that was started really right in the very beginning, probably by year 2 or 3. It started just after I took my bhikkhu ordination. And it's something that actually Ajahn Sudanto brought from, he had been part of a fledgling group trying to do some of this at Wat Phnom Cha in Thailand before he came back here to join the community and establish some kind of ground rules about how to do that, and with a particular emphasis on really listening, developing the listening skills to other people and not interrupting, and different qualities of right speech that produced a sense of harmony, or at least of understanding each other as best we could. And pretty much since that time, maybe with just a handful of exceptions, this group has gone on every 2 weeks since that time. And I think we're one of the few, if maybe not the only monastery, who has been able to sustain that. There's been other Western monasteries that have established that for periods of time. But I think Abhayagiri might be the only one that has started it and sustained it for now like probably 23 years. And find that it's just indispensable for keeping our community communication going. Ajñaka referred to practicing nonviolent communication the other day, and we had early on, maybe 4 or 5 years into our community, we had a facilitator come and spend a weekend with us, and she helped teach us some of those skills of nonviolent communication. And maybe a lot of the technical details have kind of faded away over the time, but in a way the spirit remains. Probably could use a refresher on that at some point. But just really emphasizing that you know, and it doesn't always mean that it's easy. We certainly have had our difficult times and hot spots, but that willingness to step back, listen, and try and understand each other as best we can. And sometimes it doesn't work, and sometimes conflicts can go on for a while, disagreements. But as far as I know, I don't think we've ever had any incidents of people breaking out into physical violence, which isn't always the case. We've been able to get through it without somebody clubbing somebody over the head at this point. But that remains a very strong ethic here, and I think is one reason why we've been able to do so well over the long term. And then, of course, the training of the mind, the practice of developing attitudes of patience. Sometimes I think the teachings that the Buddha gives on the antidote for ill will or aversion being loving kindness is a bit misinterpreted sometimes, because it's very hard in the heat of the moment if you're in a conflict or if somebody's coming to you with some harsh words and it's causing a sense of anger, irritation to arise in one. It's really hard to just kind of revert to a state of loving kindness. You know, most people, including myself, aren't all that skilled into just, you know, dissolving any kind of irritation that's arising and regarding somebody, you know, kind of pasting loving kindness on top of the situation. And, you know, trying to do that just becomes a bit inauthentic. You can always smile and say, may you be well, but that's not what you're thinking. So I think that in the heat of the moment, the parami that we need to pull into effect is patience, which Ajahn Sumedho has defined very well as peaceful coexistence with the unpleasant is a good definition of patience. So learning how to just be spacious when there is difficult, unpleasant situations happening. And then the loving kindness, the metta, is something that we have to develop when we're not in the heat of conflict. So before the conflict arises, when we're feeling strong and good, we develop that sense so that more and more over time, when difficult situations do arise, we kind of have had experience with it. We've developed it to at least some extent that we can pull it into practice rather than trying to invent it right there on the spot. So it's a metta, karuna, the brahmaviharas are these boundless, spacious states of mind that we develop when we're not necessarily in the heat of the moment, so that we can have them available to us at least to some extent later on. So loving kindness, those are the three, body, speech, and mind, the three of these bases for communal harmony. And then quite practically, the Buddha says another basis for communal harmony is acting with generosity, always remembering to give, and to give from one's heart. And to make that an actual conscious practice every day, even to the extent of the content, as he says, the contents of one's alms bowl, passing on what we have, sharing so that each of us has equal opportunity for having the requisites, and that nobody is left without, depending on what is given to the Sangha as a whole. So always maintaining acts of generosity with our companions on a daily basis. And then holding in common the rules of training, the ethical behavior, the guidelines, the precepts that we maintain, particularly those that are oriented towards non-harming, treating each other with respect, and the precepts around right speech, right action, maintaining these qualities. And the sixth one of this set is one that the Buddha refers to as actually the most important of all six, and that's maintaining a commonality in our right view, basically right view as is described in the Noble Eightfold Path, that this is one of the most important aspects of living together harmoniously, is kind of having a common basis for what we're doing here together. And this is, in a way, it's particular to the right view, is particular to the Buddha's teachings, and therefore particularly applicable to a monastic community, but also in a household, particularly if you've got a practice of Buddhist meditation and ethics, then bringing these to the fore in how you reflect on the values of your family or your relationships, even if you're lucky to be able to bring it to your workplace. It doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, as a Buddhist doctrine, because a lot of the aspects of right view can be just picked up as they are without necessarily referring to the Buddhist doctrine. But it helps in a community like this that we have this template. And there's a lot of aspects to right view, both mundane right view and transcendent right view. But in terms of communal harmony, I think a few of the most important things to reflect on and to talk about with each other and to have in common is the aspect of right view that says that our actions have results. Essentially, this is the law of karma. We don't have to use those words, but just have to have this sense and appreciation that what we do and how we speak, how we act, makes a difference. How we think makes a difference. We're not just victims of our own conditioning. Certainly we experience the results of our ways of thinking and speaking and acting in terms of karmic results. But the whole teaching around intention and the fact that we can recognize how our conditioning informs our body and speech and thinking process, and we can see if it's wholesome or healthy or unskillful or skillful, and we can change that. We have the capacity to change. I think that's one of the main things of aspects of right view that helps promote communal harmony. We can look and see how what we're doing affects ourselves, how it affects other people. And if it's not working, we don't have to stay stuck in it. We don't have to judge other people either. We don't have to pigeonhole people. That's so easy to do. We have ways that we perceive other people. And sometimes, you know, we all have our strong patterns and our strong habits. but to assume that they're intractable, or to assume that somebody will never change or that we'll never change, is a wrong assumption. So that capacity to redirect through mindfulness and really making an effort to change our patterns of thinking and speech and action, and to really experience that and watch what the results are, and to realize that it takes time to do that, and that these old habits can take quite a bit of time to change, but that over time and with right effort, that can be done. So it's interesting that the Buddha points to something like that as a basis for communal harmony, because it is pointing out that we, you know, have that capacity, and that others have that capacity. So in a sense, we don't give up on each other. And also, another part of that right view is actually establishing the sense that liberation is possible, that we understand that there is suffering and that there is dissatisfaction, and that the world as it stands doesn't really offer us a very stable, long-term sense of happiness, but that there is that possibility, and that possibility to experience a complete ending of suffering, the ending of dukkha. And with that understanding, that deep conviction, then that's the common value that we all have. If we have that common value, then we use the tools that we have, we use the conditions that we have to keep working towards that, and supporting each other doing that. If we didn't have that kind of common belief or common value, that common view, then we'd probably find ourselves going off in many different directions and not being able to live together nearly so harmoniously. And then, of course, the understanding of the Four Noble Truths. This is, of course, our basic teaching. The Buddha calls it the elephant's footprint for all of the teachings. Everything can fit into the Four Noble Truths. So understanding how suffering arises, understanding how it ceases, and following the path leading to that. So these are core basics of this common view that is noble and emancipating, noble and liberating, as the Buddha calls it, as a basis for communal harmony. And we have to keep refreshing that. We have to keep reminding ourselves. We talk about it, we study it, and we talk about how to put it into place. There's in this teaching that he's giving to these monks who are quarreling, he also kind of expounds a little bit on the qualities of people who do practice these six Saraniya Dhammas, particularly those in relation to establishing really experiencing to a deep level this this right view, these qualities of, you know, I was just talking about in terms of the common right view, as a way of reviewing, you know, like, am I somebody who's really putting this into practice, and am I really realizing the results of it? And talks about another set of characteristics or qualities to reflect on and say, well, does this happen in my life? Have I nourished the path to the extent that these qualities or these knowledges have arisen? And it's a good one, I think, for us in a monastic community. And I think we do kind of review these in ourselves and with each other informally, not as necessarily a formal set, but on a regular basis we talk about them. And the first set is just kind of looking at our minds and our meditation practice. We put a lot of emphasis on meditation and cultivation. of the heart, and looking to see if our minds are starting to shed the hindrances, the qualities of obstruction that impede us, the sense desire, the aversion, ill will, the drowsiness and the agitation and the doubt that Lungpa was talking about in his guided meditation this morning, looking back at those, and also the qualities of, you know, are we involved in getting in conflict with each other or not, which was pertinent to the situation that the Buddha was addressing at the time. But looking back and reviewing that and saying, does my mind experience freedom from these hindrances? If not all the time, of course, you know, for periods of time. This is one of those reviewing knowledges of somebody who has made some progress on the path through application. It's like saying, yes, there have been occasions when my mind is free from these obstructions. And the second quality, which comes as a kind of as a result of that, is reviewing and asking if one obtains kind of an internal peace of mind, a serenity or a settling. Does the mind seem more relaxed and contented and peaceful than it did before? Not necessarily, again, you know, unbroken samadhi, but is it experiencing that sense of release and peace through application of the heart to settling? So one should ask oneself that question to see if you're going in the right direction. And then another knowledge that arises is do I see any other dispensation other than the Buddha's path that will result in this same goal of liberation? And realizing that really, other than what the Buddha teaches, there are many other spiritual paths, but in terms of a complete relinquishment and complete liberation from existence in samsara and establishing a true peace of mind that is irrevocable, there really is no other dispensation in the world that will attain that. And that's not meant to be like exclusive or saying that, you know, we've got it right and everybody else has got it wrong. And the Buddha was very careful about how he spoke about that. And, you know, people would say, well, you know, are you saying that your way is the only way? And he wouldn't say, yes, that's true, my way is the only way. He would say, well, for a person, a being, to attain full liberation from samsara, there needs to be all of the factors of the Eightfold Path. So if you've got all of the factors of the Eightfold Path, as I've talked about them, then whatever you call it, whether it's Buddhism or another religion, it will lead to the same place. But if you don't have all of these factors, then it won't lead to complete liberation. So that was his way of establishing that. And if you have that sense, that conviction, then you've essentially established yourself with the faculty of faith. You know, you have complete confidence in the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha. And that's a hallmark of somebody who's firmly on the path to liberation. And I think that people here, I mean, we bring that up as a constant reflection, the establishment of confidence in the path through our own experience, not through just blind belief, but through walking the walk. And I think that there's a strong sense of that faith here in this community that keeps us bound together, walking in the same direction. We have that conviction that this is really a good thing and it really works and it has results. Another one of these factors that is good to reflect on is whenever it is that we do have a transgression of one of our rules, then we immediately, as soon as we see it, As soon as we know that that's happened, we acknowledge it in the presence, usually, of somebody else, or as soon as possible. And this is a hallmark of somebody who feels quite confident in the path. It doesn't mean that we don't make mistakes. And we all make mistakes, whether it's with our partners or our community that we're living in. You know, there are times when our mindfulness isn't perfect, and we have to acknowledge that. And the best way to do that is to just immediately bring it to the surface and make it known in a public, or at least in a one-to-one way with somebody else. And part of our tradition and that we hold faithful to is really keeping a very strict observance of the precepts. And when we do have a, whenever we do mess up and transgress a rule, at the very least, every 2 weeks right before the bi-weekly chanting of the Padimokkha rules of discipline, there's a confession where we confess to another monk anything that we can recall that we didn't hold the standard to. So that's built into the system, and I think most of us are quite sensitive to that. So that really helps to acknowledge and to just kind of be transparent. You know, this is a very transparent community. We all kind of know each other's business most of the time, and just try and make it so that it feels comfortable to be able to acknowledge when it is that we mess up. It's not wrong or bad to be a human being and to learn from that. So holding that is in a really high value. Also something I think that's really pertinent to life here at Abhaya Giri is realizing that even if we're somebody who's engaged in a lot of work for the community, doing things, holding positions of responsibility, or you know, in certain monastic offices or certain duties that we have, that even though we're involved with that a lot, we hold in our hearts the recognition and the belief in the practice that leads to what's called the higher mind, the adicitta. So that even if we're engaged with doing things and not able to spend quite as much time with the formal development of our meditation practice, we use what we've got and what we're doing as the basis for developing skillful, wholesome states of mind, and keep in mind the purpose for the activities that we find ourselves engaged in. And, you know, that's just really important in a place like this where there's a number of things that always need to be done just to keep the community and the property and the everything functioning smoothly, to realize that it's not just for the sake of doing a task or making the garden lovely or cooking the best meal, or any of those kinds of functional things, but it's always dedicated to the purpose of developing a peace of mind and developing the path. So keeping that value always at the forefront, no matter what we're doing, no matter how engaged we are. And then the last two of these reviewing knowledges would be that when we do have the opportunity to come together and listen to Dhamma teachings and be part of that, that we take full advantage of that. And as the Buddha says, we listen with eager ears so that we pay attention, listen intently, and really try to take it in and, you know, make it part of our inner being, processing as it comes out. And then lastly, taking that teaching, taking the practice, and finding inspiration from it, really letting it move deeply into our being, and taking delight in it, and remembering that really of all the possible ways of living in the world, having a life that's centered around the realization of Dhamma, and supporting all of the factors and working towards developing all of the factors in our life, our family, our community, that keep that alive, that support that, So we, you know, adapt that or adopt that as our primary MO. This is how we want to operate in life, because we know it's what's going to lead to the highest happiness. And we know that it's not necessarily an easy path, but finding support from each other in our community, in our family, in our monastic sangha, and holding these ways of developing harmony, because this is really, you know, I think the main thing that I've just gotten so much embedded in me over the past 25 years of being here is how rare and how important it is to keep this teaching alive in the world. I feel so grateful to have been here for all of this time and in the presence of Lungpa, who's been here almost since the beginning, and all the others who have come and gone and who are still here, and that strong commitment to keeping together a group of people who, you know, really are committed, and committed to being with each other, committed to living with each other, and to the broader community who has been here since before the beginning, to keep this thread alive. I mean, this is part of a thread that goes back more than 2,500 years, and I think, you know, of course, it isn't exactly the same as when the Buddha was alive, but it holds a pretty strong thread, and we've resisted, you know, all of the forces of trying to kind of adapt and change in ways that take us too far away from this central thread that takes us all the way back. So, you know, sometimes people, and they do refer to us as a bit anachronistic, out of pace, you know, that I remember even hearing, you know, in the early days, some members of other meditation communities here on the West Coast saying, well, if you want to see something that's, you know, really, really a throwback to to old times, that, you know, doesn't have much applicability to here and now, go up to a Bayagiri. It's just realizing that, well, at least there's a thread here, so that, you know, as adaptations occur and adjustments occur, they can pull from our tradition, but there's still this thread that goes all the way back with authenticity that people can, you know, periodically dip into. It's a living tradition that I find I'm just filled with gratitude to be able to be part of. So I don't know how much longer it will last. I hope a long time. You know, we don't know what's going to happen in terms of the world around us and fires. And we've had two fires across the valley just this past month or so. And luckily they were contained. We had another one a few years ago that came onto the property but spared us. So far so good. But we don't really know how long it's all going to last. Just have to be ready to pick up and move on if things change. But in the meantime, to really take advantage of what we've got and nourish our community and keep on practicing towards that goal. So I think I'll leave it there for now. Here comes Santideva.
Han namayang dhamma kataya sadhu karang dadamase
sadhu sadhu.